Welcome to Standing Room Only, featuring lectures, town hall meetings, and other public forums recorded on location by WFHB community volunteers. This program amplifies voices not adequately represented in mainstream media to help raise public consciousness of issues affecting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Tonight on Standing Room Only, linking arms for social justice. On March 30th, the Bloomington Commission for the Status of Women hosted a panel discussion entitled Linking Arms for Social Justice, which took place at City Hall. The panel focused on issues of intersectionality, along with how gender intersects with other identities. The panelists included Sheila Kennedy, who spoke on misogyny, Frances Trix, who spoke on immigration, race, and religion, Christy Pop, who spoke on immigration, and Amrita Myers, who spoke on intersectionality with a focus on women of color. Yael Cassander from WFIU moderated the event. Kathy Fuentes-Rower accepted the Emerging Leader Award at the beginning of this lecture. Today's audio was provided courtesy of Community Access Television Services. We begin today's program with Yael Cassander introducing the panel.
So I don't want to spend too much time introducing the event because we have obviously four experts here who can do a lightning round in terms of getting us up to date with regard to social justice and activism. Our topic tonight is battling fear and hatred of the other. That means the other women, certain immigrants, people of color, and people of certain religions. Because yes, within our ranks, there is infighting, believe it or not. We'll be discussing women's rights and social activism tonight. And especially tonight, we're going to be talking about the way that gender intersects with other identities and how these intersections contribute to unique experiences of oppression and privilege. While we all are, in some ways, subject to gender discrimination, other factors from age to race to sexual orientation, religion, ability, culture, and more, combine to determine our social location. So this idea of intersectionality proposes that the whole can be devastatingly greater than the sum of its parts, that sexism, when it's coupled with, for example, racism, becomes an exponentially worse form of discrimination and exclusion. Our panelists, who you see there, are going to begin by each offering 10 minutes of remarks on the following topics: immigration, race, and religion, and those will be covered both by Christy and Frances. Also, intersectionality, Amrita will be focusing on that with a focus on women of color, and misogyny, Sheila will be speaking about that. After each panelist speaks, I will prompt our discussion with a question or two, and I encourage the panelists to comment on each other's questions and to build on each other's statements in order to highlight these intersections and divergences, and of course, to suggest strategies for taking action. I'm thinking that I will first just quickly introduce the four of you and then let you individually introduce yourselves, since time is of the essence. Going from stage left to stage right, we have Amrita Myers, a gender studies and history professor with an interest in women of color. Next, it's Christy Pop, a public interest-oriented immigration attorney. After that, we have Frances Trix, who is professor emerita in anthropology with a focus on refugees. And Christy and Frances have been very active in the efforts to get the Syrian refugees to Bloomington. Finally, Sheila Kennedy, an IUPUI professor, journalist, and former director of ICLU. She'll be speaking on misogyny tonight.
I'm Sheila Kennedy, and I was asked to speak tonight about misogyny, which, believe it or not, is something I've never spoken about before. And of course, the dictionary definition of a misogynist is somebody who hates women. People who hate women aren't our problem. Our problem is men and women who've been socialized into patronizing, paternalistic attitudes about women. Some of the most offensive of those attitudes, I'm sorry, come from religion. In some denominations, especially very fundamentalist, literalist ones, The doctrinal belief is that women should be submissive. Fortunately, I'm not a member of one of those religions because it would have been exceedingly difficult for me. But men are supposed to be, in that theology, the head of the household. Those religions tend to view women primarily as incubators and strongly oppose the notion that we should be able to control our own bodies or make our own reproductive decisions. Adherents of those religions, people who genuinely feel that those are the correct beliefs, are very unlikely to respond to feminist arguments, and my suggestion is we ignore them till they die. But anyway, the more misogynistic, I can't even talk, attitudes are really holdovers from social attitudes that really were once not only widely held, but not as nefarious as we might think. There were reasons for those attitudes. Before reliable birth control, wives really were dependent on their husbands, and the few married women in the workforce were less than reliable employees. When most jobs required physical strength rather than intellect, women were at a disadvantage, fortunately. Well, I won't go there. You know, those kinds of realities created certain expectations about gender roles, and those expectations were incorporated into laws and customs. Cultural attitudes are really slow to change, and they're hard to change, but they do change. And certainly looking at LGBTQ laws today gives us, I mean, in my lifetime, that change has been tremendous, and so has we can change these attitudes, but it's difficult and it takes time. I will share two stories from my own. I obviously was born in the Ice Age, so I began practicing law in the late 70s, and my first experience going through the process of applying for a summer associate's position with a large law firm. At that time, you went from office to office, and the partners talked to you and this sort of thing. And I think the EEOC had been in existence maybe 7-8 years, and they were being very good about not asking me improper questions. However, I had 3 small children, and I said, you know, you probably would like to know what my child care arrangements were, because it seemed to me a fair kind of thing to talk about. At which point, one of the 2 partners in that office was so visibly relieved that I was not going to take my bra off and swirl it around before I burned it, that he said, oh, it's not that there's anything wrong with being a woman. We hired a man with a glass eye once. My son is now a partner in that law firm, and he loves telling that story. The other story actually did involve that son. He went to he had applied to colleges, and one of them, I think it was Yale actually, and they have interviews done by people who have who are graduates. So he goes to the law firm that I had been working for, that I was no longer there, and he's going to be interviewed by this guy alumna. And the man said, oh, did you have any trouble finding our office? And my son said, oh, no, my mom used to work here. Oh, whose secretary was she? He walked out. I mean, my kids are a little more hostile than I was at their age. Okay. But, you know, those are the attitudes that are much more difficult for women to overcome than out-and-out religiously based animus or those sorts of things, because people are absolutely unconscious of them. That said, we have changed. I mean, the attitudes have changed. The world in which my children and grandchildren operate is very different from the kind of world where those kinds of statements were considered quite ordinary. Women today are prominent in the workforce, and we're rapidly breaking a variety of glass ceilings, unfortunately not the one we all wanted to see broken in November. But what we need to remember is that women's progress, all social progress really, is incredibly threatening to both religious zealots and insecure men, and the two categories are not mutually exclusive. We're seeing right now a backlash, especially from Republican lawmakers. How dare we make decisions about our own reproduction? How dare we demand equal pay? How dare we demand that health insurance plans cover contraception? The most important challenges we face as women are the numerous legislative efforts to turn back the clock. And most of you saw today that our ex-governor, I'm sure, was having a sexual experience as he cast the tie-breaking vote to defund Planned Parenthood. I'm sorry. Anyway, we have to defeat those bills, and we have to work far more broadly than we have before for a more modern and capacious understanding of what equality looks like, rather than just waiting for the old attitudes and the old men who hold them to die. Thank you.
I'd be speaking not on race, because that's really not what I speak on. I'm a Detroiter, and we consider race part of life. But I'm speaking on refugees, immigration, and religion. And the picture here is of northern Iraqis coming in Macedonia. And I took it when I worked in a refugee transit camp. And I have to tell you, my work in this refugee transit camp was inspired by our ex-governor. Ex-Governor Pence, when he said that Indiana was not going to take any Syrian refugees because they might be terrorists, I won't say what I said. But I decided, well, I'm living in Indiana, and I'm going to work with Syrian families. So I flew off to Skopje and worked in refugee transit camps. So up yours, Governor, ex-Governor Pence. Negative inspiration is a fertile source. And I, again, with my white hair, people, the Middle Easterners really loved the most aged volunteer. Okay, refugees to immigrants, that makes sense, because refugee is a transitory status. Nobody wants to stay a refugee. Everybody wants to become an immigrant. So those two terms make sense together. But why religion here? And I'm not going to use religion the way Sheila Kennedy did. I'm using religion in a broad sense of attitude, that our attitude matters. And I'm using religion in the sense of how we treat the stranger. Okay? So again, I'm not using what you're, you know, if you were baptized or whatever. How do we treat the stranger? And also, does our attitude vary with the stranger's religion? And I'll be happy to talk about Islam, because I've worked with Muslims for my entire life. And here, a lot of the strangers tend to be Muslims, but Muslims are various too. And one of my favorite scriptural citations is from Hebrews 13, "Do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers, for thereby some have entertained angels unaware." That's one of my favorites. An overview, and again, I have 10 minutes, so I'm going to be fast, but I've taught English overseas, so I'll speak very clearly, but fast. Okay. I'll be talking first about refugees in the world and at home, why the numbers are so high, women's issues, and then the Bloomington Refugee Support Network. I'll be talking about 3 minutes on immigrants, because we have a real expert right here to my left. And then I'll be talking about religion in this broad sense, receiving the stranger in village, city, and town, and then briefly about sanctuary. First, refugees in the world and at home. Why are the numbers of refugees so high? After World War I, there were not about. No, there's never exact numbers with refugees. People understand that. There were about 9 million refugees. After World War II, there were about 30 million refugees. I don't know if you can realize the horror of that. But in 2016, there's 65 million refugees and IDPs. What it is we count also IDPs. What are IDPs? Internally displaced people. And that means in a country, you can have a country like Syria that now we've just crossed the threshold of 5 million refugees. But Syria is also full of IDPs, internally displaced people, people that have been pushed out of their homes there too. Now, women's issues, I could give a whole 20 minutes, half hour, but I can't. Sexual assault of female refugees, alas, is very common. When you're a refugee, you don't have your usual support networks. And I could talk to you about the refugees I worked, the Balkan refugees in the 90s, and how common sexual assault was. But the women's issues are more than sexual assault. There's the problem of women raising families as single parents in societies with strict gender roles. How can they get jobs to bring in food? Let's talk about survival. There's also, in U.S., vetting favors families with both parents. How many refugee families do you see with single mothers? Very few, like zero. The Bloomington Refugee Support Network, Diane Legomes, will you please stand up? We have a wonderful organizer. An absolutely superb organizer. The main organizer through Beth Shalom and 80 other faith communities and organizations, over 350 people in Bloomington. This was mostly in 2016, and it continues. It's a volunteer network to support refugees and refugee settlement in Bloomington. We had hopes to have 20 refugee families here this month in March, but alas, the political changes have thwarted this, and we're still going ahead. Okay, next. Immigration, I'm going to speak very little on this. Many immigrants are forced migrants. They go for the sake of their family or to survive. They send back funds or come back for family members. Most of us who came to America, we came because of famine in Germany, Ireland, Scotland, Norway, or pogroms in Russia or Poland. I grew up in Detroit. It's a city of immigrants, Arabs of all kinds, Albanians, Poles, Italians. Christy will speak more on this in Monroe County. Done with immigration. Religion. Can we welcome the stranger? Are we afraid of people who are different than ourselves? Let's look at how we're doing. With Syrian refugees in 2016, the U.S. took in about 13,000 Syrian refugees. Canada, little Canada, little not in geography, but little in population, took in 39,000 Syrian refugees. Germany took in over 400,000 Syrian refugees in 2016. How about refugees in general? How are we doing? We're a country of immigrants. America's usually really good with refugees. The U.S., with a population of 320 million, took in 70,000, only 70,000 refugees last year. Germany, with a population of 80 million, took in 1 million refugees. This is another, I guess I would call this negative, positive inspiration. So I went to Germany last fall. I said, Germany's doing a really good job. Germany's got a so-so reputation in other areas. But if Germany with 80 million people could take in 1 million refugees, let's find out what they're doing. So all last fall I spent in Germany going all over because Angela Merkel did something really good. She said every community in Germany must take 1.5% of its population in refugees. So I went and I said, let's find out the good programs we're going to learn from the Germans. So, what are the Germans doing right? Now, that doesn't mean they're doing everything right. So I went to every, and I had German 45 years ago. Mein Deutsch ist nicht sehr gut, aber I can fake a lot of languages. I'm good with languages, so any case. So, this is Rita Andres from Elsach. It's a village of 4,000. I visited villages, towns, and cities to see good programs. She has a Bioladen. She has an organic store. And she's here with Aslan, a refugee. She convinced the mayor in the town that he wanted to put all the refugees in the poorhouse, put them all together. That's organizationally easy, isn't it? And Rita said, not so good. What if the washing machine doesn't work? You might have to fix it. She said, if you spread the refugees out, other people might have to fix their washing machines, huh? They might learn German better if they were spread out. Good idea. So spread the refugees out into 9 different places across this little village. Rita buys monthly train tickets that the refugees can share so they're not stuck in this little tiny village. They can go to Freiburg. And anyhow, Rita promotes interaction. That's good. The best towns, this is a town of 60,000, a place called Schwäbisch Gmünd, absolutely lovely. That's the mayor and the refugee officer. She's an attorney that worked in family law, and she thought she would have more time with her 3 children doing this. I looked at her and I hooted with laughter. I said, community work's going to give you more time? Ha ha. But they're wonderful. The mayor had refugees. He put them living with his elderly parents as a model. And guess what? The rest of the town said, if the mayor can do it, we can do it. So 40% of the refugees in that town were living with private citizens. Do you think they learned German faster? Yep. The refugees also participated in the summer festival. Some volunteered for the volunteer fire department. They have a cafe every 2 weeks that has local residents and refugees, and they come and they interact. Next one. This is the last one. Mentoring program in city schools. This was in Hamburg. This is a large city of 1.8 million. The mentors of refugee children, the mentors themselves are former refugees. These are 2 mentors. They were from Afghanistan. They're now university students. The refugee students look up to these mentors as idols. They mentor them 4 hours a week in the school and then take them on a cultural event once a month. It's a fantastic mentoring program. The sanctuary movement in the United States, there are now 800 churches in 45 states. It's a growing movement. This is not new. We've done sanctuary movements before. It's a response to the new immigration executive orders and procedures. The UU Church in Bloomington has voted for it unanimously. Bravo. Any members here at that church? Everybody clap for them. I hope other faith communities will work in supporting roles. Indianapolis has the IndyCan movement. There's a growing movement in Indianapolis for sanctuary. I think this is what we need to do. Again, lots of times it's to keep people while they're in court, and this is really important. Finally, this is conclusion. I think I'm right at the end. Critical to work with refugees in Germany in every village, town, and city are the Ehrenamtliche, the honor officers. That's German for volunteer. The volunteers, the Germans couldn't do anything they've done without the volunteers. And I think we know from Bloomington, this is a city of volunteers. And things work when you have volunteers. As a woman said to me in a shelter for refugee women and small children in Macedonia, I give 1 finger and I get back 10 fingers of love. Thank you.
You've been listening to Winking Arms for Social Justice on Standing Room Only on WFHB. You just finished listening to Sheila Kennedy and Francis Trix give their opening remarks on the Linking Arms for Social Justice panel. The panel aimed to discuss issues of intersectionality and feminism. This panel was sponsored by the Bloomington Commission for the Status of Women and took place on March 30th at City Hall. Other panelists included Christy Popp and Amrita Myers. Yael Cassander was a moderator for the event. Today's audio was provided courtesy of Community Access Television Services. Turn now to Christy Popp beginning her remarks.
Christy Popp is an immigration attorney, and you've been working with Francis on the efforts to bring Syrian refugees to this town and the state. Please tell us what you've been doing.
Okay. That's not the topic that I'm planning to talk on, but I'm happy to. I actually worked with Diane at Beth Shalom last year. We started the program at Beth Shalom, which then turned into the Bloomington Refugee Support Network. I haven't taken a leadership role in the BRSN because other things have happened to occupy my time, thanks to Mr. Trump. So I mostly have been a participant rather than a leader with that. But it's definitely something that I was passionate about, or am passionate about. And for now, I think it's a bit delayed, and hopefully it will change in the future.
Great. Well, please don't delay.
Okay. So I'm not going to talk about refugees from Syria, but I hope to touch on refugees from Central America. The real topic that I want to focus on are vulnerable populations, particularly in the United States and here in Bloomington, undocumented women and children from Mexico and Central America. And, you know, I say this somewhat with reluctance in talking just about this group, because as a society, when we think of undocumented individuals, we automatically think of Mexicans. Mm-hmm. And that's really a shame, because not all undocumented people are Mexican. I personally have undocumented clients from the Netherlands, from the United Kingdom, from Canada, from Australia, from the Middle East, from every part of the world. And the reasons that people become undocumented are vast. But because I only have 10 minutes, I'm going to just narrow it and talk about the most vulnerable group, which will be the women and children from these areas. So I'm going to talk first about Mexico and then about Central America, and I'm going to do it very fast because I have a lot to talk about. I'm not sure I'll make it. So first with Mexicans, you know, I want to talk about why Mexican women and children are here. Why did Mexicans come here? And it's really important to not think of Mexican immigration in a vacuum. It's not just people who came here because they wanted to make more money. Nothing happens politically in a vacuum. The relationship between the United States and Mexico has always been one that's sort of been in flux and changing a lot. There's always been people coming across the border back and forth for many generations. In fact, much of the United States, most of it, used to be part of Mexico. In the 1980s and 1990s, some things changed. There were some key factors that really caused our current problem, if you want to call it that, of illegal immigration. One of the major ones was NAFTA. NAFTA created open borders for trade, and we flooded the Mexican markets with our agriculture goods, which put Mexican farmers out of business. Farm workers no longer had work. Subsistence farmers no longer could just afford to feed their families. And we started to see a lot of campesinos and people from Mexico coming across the border. The second thing was IRA-IRA, and that's the name of the law that was signed by President Clinton in 1996. And this, the purpose of some of the very punitive measures of the Immigration Reform Act was to deter people from coming to the U.S. But the penalties actually had the opposite effect. So, for example, one of the penalties is that if you come to the U.S. and you have unlawful presence for more than a year and you leave the country, you can't come back for 10 years. And if you come to the U.S. for more than 1 year, leave the country, come back illegally again, you're barred permanently from getting status. So you can imagine if you're married to a citizen, you entered the country illegally, you can't get status in the U.S., you have to go home to get a visa, but if you leave the country, you can't come back for 10 years. So you'll be separated from your family. You know, this sort of problem has meant that people don't want to go home. Of course, these are just two small examples, but I think they have contributed greatly to why there are more people here. Also, the enhanced border security makes it more difficult to come and go, so people just end up staying. At this time, in fact, with Mexican migration, there's a negative net migration, so there are more Mexicans leaving than coming to the United States. But many of the undocumented Mexicans who are here have been here for a decade or more. People are settled here. So why didn't they come in legally in the first place? Well, first of all, there's no line. Like, let's just get rid of that idea. There's no line in immigration. There are lots of different lines. But honestly, most people don't have an option. To come here, you have to generally have a petitioner, which would be a citizen or permanent resident family member, or an employer who can petition for you. And even if you do have a family member for some categories, you have to wait 15 to 30 years for a visa. So these are long waits that people are waiting, separated from their families. And then once you have come in illegally once, you're precluded from getting almost most other statuses. So you kind of, that just creates a bigger problem. So now we have a situation where people have been here for a decade or more. They have married. They have kids. The kids are citizens. The kids are growing up and going to school, going to college. They own homes. They own businesses. And they don't want to leave that. They are, for all intents and purposes, citizens of our country, but for that title. But now they have a big problem, which is that entering the country illegally is a misdemeanor, a one-time misdemeanor, not a continuous misdemeanor. If they came in on a visa and overstayed, it's not a crime at all. But yet, here they are with this one-time misdemeanor. And I like to ask when I give this presentation, how many people have committed misdemeanors and never got caught? I mean, honestly, right? Okay, when I ask college students, like, every hand goes up. People are forgetting. All right. But so imagine this, that, you know, you commit your one-time misdemeanor, possession of marijuana, okay? You weren't caught. Then let's say 15 years down the road, the police find out about it, and they come to you and they say, oh, well, now we're going to take away your family. We're going to separate you from your family. We're going to take away your house. We're going to take away your business. We're going to take away this whole life you've known and send you back to a country that you have no family in anymore. So it's a pretty significant punishment for having once committed a misdemeanor or perhaps just overstayed a visa and not a crime at all. So immigrants are scared. They're very scared, and it's creating a lot of problems and making them even more vulnerable than they were before. Particularly, I'm concerned with victims of domestic violence. Okay, you know, it's a big problem in all populations, including in the Latino population. And when women are scared to call the police because either they're afraid that they're going to be picked up and put in jail, or the breadwinner, the father of their children, is going to be deported if he gets put in jail, they're not going to call the police for their protection. Also, because ICE picked up a transgendered person in court who went there for an order of protection, that person was picked up by ICE in Texas, so now people are scared to go to court to get orders of protection. And recent reports have shown that families are canceling food stamps and Medicaid. So, and their children who are citizens are entitled to these benefits. So now we're going to see children suffer and not get the food they need. Women who are entitled to WIC are not going to get the formula that they need for their children. So it's a big problem, and I think that the situation is going to be getting worse for these vulnerable populations. I feel like the work that advocates have been doing for years to sort of break down these barriers between law enforcement and government and immigrants is really being dismantled in a matter of months. It's really going way quickly. Okay, that was fast. I'm going to try to go through Central America really fast. And I separate out these two because the problems are very different. Now, there are many Central American migrants who came to the United States over the years who have been here for decades, who have the same issues of Mexican women and children that are undocumented. But I want to talk about a different group, a group that doesn't get much attention in the media, and this is the tens of thousands of Central American refugees who have come over our border in past years. And you know, the media portrays them as being not refugees, but as being undocumented immigrants or illegal immigrants, and they're not. They are legit refugees. So why did they come? Well, like with Mexico, you know, the pushes and pulls of immigration have changed a lot. In the 1980s, we saw a lot of Central American migrants or Central American refugees come fleeing war. And then in the 1990s, a lot of it was economic reasons. But then in the late 90s, in the early 2000s, the United States started deporting gang members, back to El Salvador and Honduras and Guatemala, and we didn't tell the governments we were deporting gang members. And those gang members formed gangs and got involved in drug trafficking and became these extremely, extremely powerful organizations that basically control particularly Honduras and El Salvador. Those two countries, especially Honduras, have been among, if not the, most dangerous countries in the world for many years now. The gangs are violent. They recruit young teenaged boys forcibly. If you refuse, you get killed. They force women into relationships. And I have a client who is an asylum seeker because she was in a forced relationship with a gang member for about 5 or 6 years. And the violence is brutal. You cannot get out. There's a huge problem with femicide in El Salvador, the ritual, the killing of women. Infanticide, the gang members will kill children just to get at the women. So the countries are horrible. So people are fleeing. Teenage boys, children, and women are fleeing. And it is an extremely dangerous flight to get to the United States. First, you have to go through Mexico. They ride on a train called the Beast, which many people don't survive. They sit on top. And a lot of people fall off and are killed or are maimed. Women are raped. Women are sexually assaulted. Let's say they make it through Mexico. The drug traffickers will get them. They'll kidnap them. They'll kill them. If they get through the drug traffickers, they have to walk through a desert where many people don't make it. So it's horribly dangerous. So why do they come? Well, I like to quote the poet Orson Scheier, who says, the famous poem Home, and she says, "No one leaves home unless home is the mouth of a shark. No one puts their children in a boat unless the water is safer than the land." And that's exactly why people keep coming, because it's so horrible at home that it's worth it. Just a few points about a couple more points about refugees here in the U.S. So they are not treated very well when they come here. They are not welcomed with open arms. We are not celebrating the fact that we are welcoming so many refugees and giving them legal status here and benefits. No, we put them in jail. We put them in detention, and we call them undocumented. And until recently, when there was big litigation, we were putting the children in jail. They were given jumpsuits. They were maybe given crayons. And the conditions were horrible. So after some lawsuits, the Obama administration let up a little bit. They were releasing mass numbers of women and children. But it looks like the Trump administration is going to change their policies. One major thing, Obama administration created a Central American Minor Refugee Program. So certain children who qualified could apply to be refugees in El Salvador, Honduras, and then come here avoiding that horrible trip. Well, the halting of the refugees that Trump did with his executive order halted that program. So those children no longer have access to the U.S. The Trump administration has said, since they can't jail children, they're going to separate moms and children. They're going to put the children in government-run shelters and put the moms in detention. They're making it more difficult for people to establish that they have asylum during the screening program. And it's hard to establish asylum, and they're making it even harder. And finally, they said they're going to stop treating unaccompanied minor children as children with special benefits that get released to their parents or have other sort of benefits from the government. They're going to start treating them just as any other undocumented immigrant, and that means deporting them. And to give you an idea, over the last 3 years, there were 155,000 unaccompanied minor children who entered the United States. So the numbers that we're talking about in people is quite large.
Let's move on to Amrita's presentation on intersectionality. Thanks.
Good evening. Oh, you're going to have to respond back. Good evening. Yeah, I do call and response. So I'm a historian by training, for those of you who don't know me. And I focus, my work is on Black women in the U.S., and so I wanted to focus a little bit today. I was asked to talk about intersectionality, and I started thinking about sort of the historical problems that we've had in the U.S. in terms of the women's movement in having something that really approaches an intersectional feminism. Because, and that's not just from the 1960s, I'm going back to the 1830s and 40s and looking at the first, you know, what I really consider the first wave of women's activism and feminist movements in the U.S., going back to the Seneca Falls Convention in the 1840s, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and that particular generation of activists, right? And that there's been this constant problem with not only issues of racism, but also, right, heterosexism and classism, and that we've, for 150 or plus more years, have struggled with this constant women's movement that looks white, middle class, suburban, heterosexual. You know, Elizabeth Cady Stanton tried to, in the beginning, work with African Americans, women and men, including Frederick Douglass, who was definitely a feminist, although he had some issues. But what happens when the battle for the 15th Amendment begins is that, you know, Elizabeth Cady Stanton basically throws all of her black allies under the bus, because when it becomes clear that the government is more interested in allowing black men to have the franchise than it is to extend the franchise to women, you know, Elizabeth Cady Stanton openly begins stumping around the country and basically saying, how dare you give, you know, these people the vote over your own mothers, daughters, and sisters? Like, her racism comes right out her back pocket the minute she realizes that they are not going to, that white women are not going to be given the right to vote. And so I think it's important that we understand that these tensions are not recent. They have a long-standing history, and I'm not recounting this history to make people cry and go home and feel bad about themselves. I tell my students on a daily basis that guilt is pointless, but you have to understand the historical context, and then you have to be willing to go and do something to become an ally, right? Guilt is pointless, allies are priceless. You can quote me on that, because that is me. I think, too, about Susan B. Anthony. Right, that this is a different kind of tension. So Ida B. Wells is probably my historical hero. And if you don't know who Ida B. Wells was, you should go look her up, because she was absolutely amazing. She spent her whole life as an anti-racist and feminist advocate, was run out of the South, had a wanted, you know, price put on her head, and she was fierce. She was the only black woman to sign the organizing papers of the NAACP, and she was one of the women who helped to found the National Association for Colored Women, which is the oldest African-American political civil rights organization in the United States, older than the NAACP. Right? She was fierce. The FBI would show up at her house, and she would, like, she carried a gun. She would just be like, what are you gonna do to me? Like, that's who she was. She was a journalist, she was a teacher, and she had been a longtime feminist advocate and a longtime friend of Susan B. Anthony's. And after Ida B. Wells got married, she went to visit Susan B. Anthony in her home. And instead of calling her Ida, which they were on a first name basis, Susan B. Anthony kept calling her Mrs. Barnett, in a real tone, Mrs. Barnett. And until Ida finally looked at her and said, you know, do you have a problem with the fact that I got married? Do you not believe in marriage? Do you have an issue with it? And she goes, oh, well, marriage is fine for some women, but not for women like you who have a calling, or like me. You know, we have work to do. Since you've gotten married, activism has practically ceased to exist. So if we're gonna talk about intersectionality, there's, you know, it's not just about race, right? Race is one of the biggies. But what about the tensions that we even have amongst two really amazing feminist advocates, where the one starts to kind of get hostile with the other because she's gotten married? Ida B. Wells went on the political circuit campaigning all over the country for feminism and race and anti-racism, hauling her children on her hip with her. Like, she carried her newborn with her on tour. Yeah, she was pretty amazing. So let's fast forward then to the era, right, the World War I era, where we have a huge increase in feminist activism as the push begins to have an amendment passed to give women the right to vote. And you have suffrage marches happening all over the country, right? And there's a really important suffrage march that's scheduled to happen in Washington, D.C. And the suffragettes decide that it wouldn't be politically correct to have black women march in the march because it would offend their Southern sisters. Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. So they essentially told all these black women activists who had been marching with them, fighting with them, advocating for suffrage, kind of like shades of Elizabeth Cady Stanton all over again, like, oh, you know, it's great to work with you when you're benefiting us, but now you might cost us the, you know, the alliance of our Southern white super racist sisters who are, you know, because we know the South is under like extreme segregation at this point. And they finally say, well, you know, you can march at the very back of the parade, the very last, like, so Ida B. Wells again, she's gonna show up again here, right? She's standing on the sidelines in DC as this march happens. And basically, the minute the parade passes her, she gets right in there at the very front, and she starts marching. Like, what, again, like she does to the FBI, what are you gonna do? Are you gonna pull me out of this parade in front of all the people and the political leaders and the journalists? She was like, come on. Nobody said boo. But it was, I mean, but you see these pictures from these, it's very, very famous pictures in black and white. The suffragettes are all wearing white dresses, but they're wearing black sashes, they're carrying these signs, they're wearing these hats. And the black women are at the very back of a very long parade line, except for Ida B. Wells, who was not about to be shoved into the back of anything. Fast forward to the 60s. Oh, we gotta talk about Betty Friedan for a second, right? I mean, and it's not just Betty Friedan, but Betty clearly had some issues when it came to gay women, let's be clear. She was actually very clear that allowing lesbians into the movement and allowing them to sort of, you know, talk about, you know, homosexual or homophobia was taking the eyes off of the really important issues that women faced, and it was diluting the movement, basically, right? That we had to just focus on the issues that we all suffered as women, and that if we started talking about racism and sexism and homophobia, it would dilute the movement and we would never get anywhere. But she wasn't the only one. You know, I mean, Angela Davis, who is still alive today, whom I respect, and who has, by the way, changed her position from what I'm about to tell you about, right? She, at one point, if you read Angela Davis's, you know, she's an incredible, she's a lawyer, professor, spent time in prison, right? A really amazing mass incarceration or anti-mass incarceration activist, traveling the country and teaching and lecturing today. When she wrote her memoir, which was written back in the 70s when she was pretty young, when she was still in jail, and she was remembering her time in jail, she talked about the fact she had real discomfort with, right, gay women. And she openly talked about the fact that these homosexual relationships that were happening in women's prisons were really a result of like the dysfunctional sort of order of jails. You know, this wasn't normal, these things, you know, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, if you talk to Angela Davis today, she'll be like, okay, I was wrong. What I said was absolutely, it was homophobic, it was inappropriate. She's evolved in her understanding, right? She's evolved in her understanding. I don't know, Betty Friedan is dead. You'd have to ask her what she thinks, I guess, about her ideas today. But so there were black and white women back in the 60s who were struggling with these kinds of intersectional tensions. So I think it's important to note that. But I do think it's also important to say that black women felt so ostracized, not only in the feminist movement, but also in some civil rights organizations, not all, but there were some that were incredibly patronizing, condescending, patriarchal, right? There were women like Ella Baker who left the Southern Conference for the SCLC, right? Which was really Martin Luther King, and it was a bunch of reverends, right? It was a bunch of ministers. Ella Baker, who's one of the most amazing black women political activists of the 20th century, who literally got the NAACP up and off the ground and running in the South, leaves the SCLC because she's tired of being condescended to by a bunch of ministers, essentially, all right? Why am I blanking on what the Southern Christian Leadership Coalition or conference? Thank you, Rafi. I'm like, you know, too many acronyms. Okay, so they feel ostracized in the National Organization for Women. They feel like it's really just about middle-class white women. They feel ostracized in places like SCLC and even the NAACP and certain other organizations. And so they're like, okay, we're gonna create our own groups. Because clearly, so gay black women, the Combahee River Collective, right? Because they feel like, well, nobody wants to listen to us. Right, black women create the National Black Feminist Organization, the National Welfare Rights Association. They have to have their own spaces where they can talk about the things that are affecting them. So even today, I'm going to talk about the march that happened in January. Was it awesome? Absolutely. Was it amazing to see millions of women across the country in daughter and sister marches everywhere? Yeah. But can I just say that I find the pink hat really problematic? Number one, not all women have a pink and there were a lot of women around the country who felt really excluded just on the basis of that symbol. And there are some women who don't have at all. Transgendered, our transgendered sisters, that's not a symbol that they can get on board with. Are we willing to actually check our own unconscious privilege? Right? I'm not even accusing people of doing this deliberately. I'm just saying that these are things that we don't necessarily think about and we do them without meaning to be harmful or hurtful. But are we willing to listen when someone says that to us, or are we going to respond with defensiveness? Right, that's what I'm really trying to, that's the question that I'm trying to pose. There is still, because of this long history, there is still tension with a lot of different groups of women about trusting one another, right? There's still the feeling or the sense that, well, there are a lot of white women out there who are interested in equality for themselves. They're interested in acquiring the power that exists for white men within the system and having access to it, but they're not really interested in changing the system and making it something different that benefits all women, right? And so this, again, are you willing to listen to women who are going to say that to you, and are you going to not be defensive or say, okay, how do we understand that white women make 77 cents on the dollar, but that black and Latinas make somewhere in the 50s and 60 cents on the dollar? Are we willing to actually link hands across those divides and say, you know what? We have to work for the benefit of all of us, because if one of us is suffering, all of us is suffering, right? That's really, really, I can't express that enough. So are we gonna think about intersectionality in these four ways? I'm probably over time, but I'm gonna wrap it up as quickly as I can. But to me, intersectionality means four things. Internally, right? So let's look at groups that are just African American women's groups. Are we as black women going to be willing to reach out and work across our own issues of homophobia and issues like not willing to work with transgendered people? Are we willing to examine those things within our own race-specific organizations and call it out when we see it? Because that intersectionality needs to happen internally to those, right, to monoracial groups as well. Are we willing to then look at intersectionality across groups? Are we willing to make alliances across race, religious, right, lines and build trust with groups that we still have suspicion of? But are we willing to at least take that first step, right, and say, okay, we need to be in this together, Native women, undocumented women, Muslim women, Latinas, African Americans, women, et cetera, right? So that's a second kind of intersectionality. Are we also willing to make our goals intersectional? Once upon a time it seemed like now, back in the 60s, it was like, is it just about abortion, or are we actually talking about something other than that? Well, I think so. The Monroe County chapter of NOW was just organized, and if you look at the goals, one of the very first ones is racial justice. Okay, and so I think it's important. Are we really interested in making sure that our goals are intersectional? Are we working on undocumented issues, right? Are we standing with our Muslim brothers and sisters, right, because they're being typecast and there's a ban against particular nations? Let's not, you know, black people are like Muslims. I'm like, there are a lot of black Muslims. Let's not forget that. Let's not forget that two of those seven countries are African nations, right? Somalia being one of them. Are we willing to stand up and say Black Lives Matter? Are we willing to stand with our Native sisters and say water is life and no pipelines across your property? Are we willing to actually look at all of the issues and not just the ones that maybe affect us personally? The last kind of intersectionality is, if we have intersectional goals, we also have to have intersectional strategies. We can't have one way of doing anything. That's not going to work. There's going to be multiple types of strategies that we're going to have to get involved in order to address multiple issues. But that can get tricky, because what it means is that we're going to have to accept that we're going to disagree. There are going to be difficulties, disagreements, there's going to be, people will get hurt feelings. It's going to happen, because you're not going to be right about everything all the time, and you're going to hear things that make you feel uncomfortable. But are we going to walk out every time we don't get our way, right? How do we react to other women who are clearly feminists and who agree with all the other, six out of the seven things that we stand for, but maybe don't agree with the seventh? How about all of those very, very strongly committed women of different faith systems who may be on board with equal pay for equal work, access to education, right, healthcare, but who may have a problem with reproductive rights, as we like to define them here in the United States? Are we going to turn our backs on those women because they don't agree with us on abortion? I'm posing the question, right? I'm posing the question. At the end of the day, are we also really invested in letting women of color speak for themselves? Or are we trying to just talk for them? Because, and this is me saying that I would like us to take a look around the room tonight, and I would like you to take a look at the panel. And this is not a criticism of the people who organized it at all. I would love to come back here next year, and I would like to see a panel of four where we have Muslim women speaking, where we have Latinas speaking, where we have Black women speaking, where we have women speaking for themselves, because guess what? Women of color don't need other people to speak for them. I know I don't.
You just finished listening to a panel entitled Linking Arms for Social Justice. This panel took place on March 30th at City Hall in Bloomington, and it was sponsored by the Bloomington Commission for the Status of Women. The discussion talked about issues of intersectionality and how gender intersects with other identities. The panelists included Sheila Kennedy, who spoke on misogyny, Frances Trix, who spoke on immigration, race, and religion, Christy Popp, who spoke on immigration, and Amrita Myers, who spoke on intersectionality with a focus on women of color. Yael Cassander moderated today's event. Today's audio was provided courtesy of Community Access Television Services.
You've been listening to Standing Room Only. Join us each week for on-location recordings of lectures, town hall meetings, and other public forums. If there's a particular event you'd like to hear broadcast on this program, email that information to us directly at news@wfhb.org. The Standing Room Only archive is available online at wfhb.org/news. Standing Room Only is a production of our volunteer-powered news and public affairs department here on Community Radio, WFHB.